Chapter 16. The flurries continued to fall as dusk settled upon the county, and night had taken full hold when Jeff finally emerged from the cover of the woods into the wide backyard of a secluded Portland residence. A few short weeks ago, the Hurricanes would have relished the chance to burglarize such a home, but that notion seemed ludicrous to him now. Still, he could not resist the temptation to take a mechanic's suit and an unlocked mountain bike from a shed at the rear of the property. "I'm just borrowing them," he told himself as he donned the denim suit, noting the property address as he rode the bicycle down the long driveway and silently into the night. He pedaled the bicycle along the dark streets on the back side of Badger Mountain until he stopped on a hillside, overlooking the evening lights of Madison dotting the valley below. Cycling along the hilly terrain helped to keep his body warm, and the blue cotton suit broke the wind from his wet clothes underneath. But as he coasted down the hill, the cold air bit his cheeks and gnawed at his knuckles that tightly clenched the bicycle handlebars for control. By the time he reached the bottom of the hill, his teeth were chattering and his skin felt raw. But as the road leveled on the outskirts of the city, the wind subsided and the flurries ceased. Soon he came upon a motel across the street from a 24-hour truck stop located near an entrance ramp to westbound lanes of Interstate 88. He parked the bike on the sidewalk and entered the motel office, paying a disinterested night clerk for a room with one of the folded $100 bills still nested inside his front pocket. A few minutes later, he opened the door to his room and flicked on the light, rolling the bicycle inside before locking the door behind him. He turned up the heater and laid his wet clothes out to dry while he took a long, hot shower to warm his body and soothe his aching muscles. Afterward, he sat on the bed, clad only in a bath towel, flicking through channels with the TV remote. He watched the news clip of his harrowing escape from the Salisbury Police Headquarters on WCRT News, reveling in the sight of Bumbles tackling Sergeant Hurst on the lawn. Yet he saw nothing about the girl whose disappearance had triggered the Amber Alert earlier in the day. He longed to call his friends for an update, but he feared that they might all be in police custody at the time. The only useful information he obtained came from an admissions nurse at Madison General Hospital, who confirmed that Mick Landry had been admitted to the hospital in serious but stable condition. She would not tell him if Cindy Wellis was also there, despite his persistence. His hands throbbed with pain as he hung up the phone, and pangs of hunger roiled his stomach. So he slipped the mechanic's suit on again and left the room with the television still on. Across the street, the lights of the truck stop shone brightly in the night, lighting his way down the desolate service road to a complex consisting of a gas station, a large convenience store, and a busy diner that he chose to avoid. Soon he returned to his room with two bags full of food, some clothing, a silver money clip, and first aid supplies, and for the next hour, he dined on corn chips, beef jerky, and soda as he bound his busted fingers together with gauze tape and cleansed his wounds with alcohol. When he was finished, he continued to flick through TV channels for information about Cindy, but eventually he could no longer resist his underlying exhaustion, so he turned down the heater and drifted off to sleep. Dawn came with a glint of sunshine upon his face, eking through a gap in the curtains. He shut off the television and rolled off the bed to place his bare feet on the carpet, with his body feeling the full effect of the previous day's battle. His jeans were mostly dry and his sneakers only slightly damp, so he dressed quickly, throwing his tattered t-shirt into the trash can in favor of a thick flannel shirt and a navy blue hoodie he had purchased at the truck stop. He left his room key card on the dresser and scribbled the address of the mountain homestead on a notepad, stuffing the note in the pocket of the mechanic's suit before draping the garment over the handlebars of the bicycle. With the sweatshirt hood pulled over his head, he stepped outside and shut the door behind him on his way toward the truck stop. the first steps on a journey toward a new home and a new way of life. The morning clouds bore brilliant streaks of crimson and indigo, scars of the powerful storm that had since passed, while the puddles he stepped around bore a faint glaze of ice. He walked briskly along the service road to the diner entrance, entering the restaurant discreetly and taking the closest seat at the counter. A waitress brought him a cup of coffee, and he sipped on it with a wary eye on an overhead TV playing the local news, worried that his story might be next in the queue. He struck up a conversation with the truckers around him, and 20 minutes later, he was climbing into the cab of a westbound truck, his new money clip $50 lighter, but his identity still secure, and his Californian quest ready to begin in earnest. As they drove westbound down the highway, the lonely truck driver showered Jeff with conversation and off-color jokes, clearly excited to have a companion for a change. Jeff obliged him for a short time, but soon his attention wandered from the passing countryside to unresolved matters back home. And an hour later, he asked the driver to let him out at an upcoming rest area just before they reached the state line. The befuddled driver assented and even offered to return the gas money, but Jeff declined and thanked the man as he climbed out of the cab. He shut the door and waited for the truck to pull away before crossing the highway for the eastbound lanes. The eastward trek proved more problematic than his westward ride had been. He left the interstate for the safety of less conspicuous state roads, and although he was able to hitch a few shorter lifts along the way, he also had to walk for long stretches between rides. The sun fell upon his back as morning turned to afternoon, but the temperature remained close to freezing for much of the day, so the snow coating the ground softened but never completely melted. The aimlessness he had felt in the truck had all but dissipated as he neared the familiar grounds of his hometown. His solitary journey back home left him tired but clear-eyed, and he felt satisfied with his decision to return, not due to any plan, but for a deeper purpose he sensed within him. He wasn't sure if it was closure or something else, but he felt angst in his heart that he knew would not be eased by simply accumulating miles upon his sneakers. As night began to fall again, he passed through a hedgerow at the base of a snowy slope, beneath a clear sky and bright evening stars. On the other side of the bushes, he gazed up at the tombstones dotting the hillside with the white wisps of his breath curling about his face. A cold breeze cascaded down the hill, prompting him to duck his chin beneath the collar of his flannel shirt before starting up the slope toward the cemetery. Halfway up the hill, his foot struck a heavy object. With a faint smile, he lifted up the crystal decanter he had discarded a few nights earlier. He brushed it clear of snow and dumped out the half inch of remaining whiskey before fishing the glass stopper from the pocket of his jeans. With one last look at the full moon through the refractive crystal, he fit the stopper back into the neck of the decanter, reassured by the notion that not everything he touched had been ruined. He cradled the decanter in his arm and continued up the hill, trusting his cloudy memory on a course past the outermost markers of the cemetery, until he finally cast his sober eyes down upon Train's grave. The gray stone glowed amid the undisturbed snow cover, while an inch of snow atop the marker beckoned him to pack a snowball. He placed the decanter on the ground and scooped up a portion of the snow, packing it as tightly as his bandaged hands allowed. An oak tree down the slope taunted him from afar, so he hurled the snowball at it, grimacing as it landed a few feet to the right of the mark. He gathered an equal portion of snow from atop Train's marker, and again tried to strike the tree with it, but this time the snowball curled just inches to the left. Determined, he turned back for the final strip of snow atop the tombstone, but his fingertips stung from the snow, so he buried his hands in the pockets of his sweatshirt and sat down with his back against the headstone. The breadth of constellations stretched all about him, and he felt at ease upon the hilltop, lost in his thoughts, with his legs splayed out before him. 10 minutes later, he heard footsteps crunching in the snow behind him. He rolled to his knees and hid behind the marker as he espied the silhouette of a tall man in a dark overcoat approaching him.
"Hello?"
the man called out.
"Jeff?"
Jeff peered out from behind the headstone. "Who's there?" The stranger did not answer at first. He continued to step deliberately through the crunchy snow until he was close enough to speak in a natural tone.
"It's Marty Jameson. I saw you from my office window. I'm the Reverend."
Jeff held his tongue until he could distinguish the Reverend's face in the low light. "From the wake. I remember you." The Reverend stopped behind the headstone.
"That's right. Your friend's wake."
Jeff cast his eyes downward. "Yeah, well, sorry about the way I acted that night. It was a bad time." The Reverend pointed to the ground.
"Mind if I sit?"
Before Jeff could reply, he tucked the tail of his overcoat beneath him and sat upon it in the snow.
"I looked for you at the funeral, but—"
"I didn't go," Jeff snapped. He turned to face the Reverend. "Look, if you're here to tell me what a rotten person I am, there's no line and no waiting, so have at it."
"No, that's not what I want."
The Reverend drew a deep breath.
"I've heard many stories about how close Train was with his friends, and from what Cindy's told me, you and he were very good friends. So I was curious as to why you would avoid the funeral altogether."
"I paid him my respects right here on this hilltop. Train was a great friend, but I still don't understand why he took that bullet for me." The Reverend nodded slowly.
"There is no greater love than for a man to lay down his life for his friends."
Jeff smiled. The preacher couldn't help preaching, but his words were of comfort nonetheless. "Too bad you never actually got to meet him when he was alive. He was a pretty likable guy."
"But I did meet him,"
the Reverend said.
"He came to my office about a week and a half ago. It was a Thursday. I remember because I was heading to the hospital for sick call. I didn't have a lot of time for him, but he insisted."
Jeff wasn't sure what he found more incredulous, that this man of faith was sitting in the snow beside him, or that he had actually conversed with Train in his church office. What did he want? The Reverend shrugged.
"Just to talk. He seemed apprehensive about something, so I sat with him for a few minutes."
Jeff recalled Train's odd behavior at the gang meeting that same afternoon. "So what did he say?"
"He felt like he had crossed a line,"
the Reverend began.
"He said he felt like he wasn't long for this world. He regretted some of the things he had done and wanted to know if, how did he put it, if he could get back to good again."
A shiver ran up Jeff's spine, for the Reverend's tale rang true. "What did you tell him?"
"I told him of a way back to good. I told him the light is always on at my front porch."
The Reverend patted Jeff on the shoulder.
"It's there for you too, if you ever want to stop by."
His words felt like a glowing fireplace in a drafty hall. Ever since that tragic night, Jeff had longed to find some meaning in his friend's death, and at Cindy's behest, he had sought to define it by the transformation of his own life. If Train had truly anticipated his own demise, as the Reverend alluded, he still mustered the courage to defend his friends in a dark alley at his own peril. The selflessness of Train's friendship felt too great for Jeff to fully comprehend, but sitting on a snowy, starlit hilltop, his heart basked in the kindred spirit of that camaraderie, and he sensed a greater measure of peace within him. "Thanks, Rev. I just might take you up on that sometime." Before the Reverend could reply, more footsteps crunched in the snow behind them. Jeff rose to his knees to peer out over the headstone toward the church. A dark figure waved a hand in the air, and a familiar voice called out.
"Hello there."
"Oh shit," he muttered. "Chief Wellis is here." The Reverend rose to his feet.
I'm sorry, Jeff. I called him before I came out here. Please don't run away.
Jeff stood up beside him and buried his frigid hands into his sweatshirt pockets again. I'm too tired to run, he said. The Reverend looked up.
Hello, Matt.
Hello, Marty,
Chief Wellis replied.
I appreciate your discretion, as always.
Jeff looked the two men over. So how do you guys know each other? The Reverend smiled.
Madison High Baseball, state champs, 2 years in a row.
The chief stroked his mustache.
Might have been three if you didn't strike out looking with bases loaded in the finals.
The Reverend laughed.
That pitch was practically in the dirt.
His smile faded when he saw Jeff quietly staring down at the grave.
Well, I'm sure the two of you have a lot to discuss.
He brushed the snow from the tail of his overcoat.
If you ever need to talk, Jeff, I'm easy to find.
He patted the chief on the back before ambling off across the snowy grounds towards the church. The chief waited until he was out of earshot before speaking again.
It's amazing how he turned out with all the trouble we used to get into.
A cop and a preacher. I can only imagine.
People change, Jeff. Sooner or later, we all figure out who we really want to be.
The chief turned to face him.
So why are you here? Your friend said you were already gone.
I tried to leave. I really did.
Well, then why?
I couldn't go without knowing she's okay, Jeff blurted out. Nobody would tell me anything. I couldn't get any information.
Some of that was by design. We were hoping to draw you out. Most of your gang has been locked up since yesterday. The tornadoes, too. The ones who aren't in the hospital, anyway.
Jeff mulled the reply. So, how is she? The chief exhaled a sigh of relief.
She was in an advanced state of hypothermia when she got to the hospital. Another hour out in the cold might have been too much for her. She's got a bruised spleen, too, but the doctor said that, overall, she's very fortunate. She's being discharged on Monday.
That's awesome. I didn't know what to think.
She gave us all a scare. But no one's been more scared than the Jenkins kid. He came out of surgery this morning, and he hasn't stopped talking since. Bottom line is, Curly McClure's going to jail for a long time. You're small potatoes compared to him.
The thought of J.J. ratting out Curly to the police detectives pleased Jeff to no small degree. Glad to hear it.
Not that you're absolved of all wrongdoing. We found a burned-out pit just outside your neighborhood, containing some remnants of stolen property. And some of your friends confirmed the site was the hurricane's hideout. And if you think you can dodge that, I've got other charges on my list for you. Breaking out of custody. Engaging an officer in pursuit.
The chief rubbed the knot on his head.
Assaulting a police officer.
You weren't a cop at the time. You said it yourself. The chief frowned.
You might win that one in court. But I don't think it'll come to that.
What do you mean?
The stories we're getting from both gangs have been pretty consistent. Considering what you were up against, most of your actions seem generally justified to me. The important thing is that we got Cindy back safely now, thanks to you.
I was trying to save her. You tried to have me shot.
You had a gun in your hand. What was I to think?
The chief buried his hands in his overcoat pockets and shuffled his feet in the snow.
Look, Jeff, I know you don't like me very much, but I'm not a man without compassion. Everyone describes your actions as nothing short of heroic. The more I hear about it, the more I appreciate what you did.
I didn't do it for you. I did it for her.
I get it. Still, she's alive today because of you, and I think that earns you a break. so I'm ready to offer you a deal.
Jeff bristled. A deal? What kind of deal? The chief looked up again.
Election day is 3 days away, and I'm in a tight race. The last thing I need right now is a lot of media attention about my sergeant strong-arming some high school kid, even if he is a gang leader. And I've got enough evidence to put Curly McClure away for a long time, without your input.
Good. But I'm not a gang leader anymore.
That's great, Jeff. But I can't just stand back and let you stroll around town either. So here's the deal. I never saw you tonight. We were never here. We never talked. No one else knows we were here either.
Jeff shook his head. The Reverend knows. Chief Wellis smiled.
Marty Jameson and I have an understanding. He doesn't try to enforce the law, and I don't try to save souls.
Jeff glared back. So you're just going to let me go? What's the catch? The chief scratched his chin as he chose his words carefully.
I'm not letting you go. I'm giving you a head start. You got 48 hours. Go wherever you want to go, and don't come back. I won't come looking for you.
A head start? But what about—
Forget about my daughter. No goodbyes, no texts, no letters, nothing.
The chief's face grew stern.
I mean it, Jeff. If I see you near her, I'm hauling you in. And I don't want to see you anywhere near the hospital either. She's endured a traumatic experience and she needs to heal.
Jeff's eyes widened. But I'd never hurt a hair on her head. I put my life on the line for her.
And I appreciate that, Jeff. I really do. Believe me, I see you in a completely different light now. But I still think that in the long run, you're just the wrong guy for her. I'm not saying that as a cop. I'm saying that as a father.
Jeff glowered at him. She's not your little girl anymore. She has a mind of her own.
That's true. Nevertheless, I'm pulling her out of Salisbury High after the election. I'm enrolling her in a private school. She won't like it, but eventually she'll make new friends. I'm guessing whatever there is between the two of you will probably fade by the time she graduates.
Jeff squeezed his fists. If you cared one bit about the way she felt—
That's the deal, Jeff. I think it's mighty generous.
The chief pulled his coat open to reveal a set of handcuffs dangling inside.
Or we can go down to the station right now. Either way, you won't be seeing her anytime soon. So what do you say?
Jeff felt so sick to his stomach that he could not even speak, only nod in acceptance. Chief Wellis clasped his gloved hands together.
Good. Then I suppose this is goodbye.
He offered a handshake, but Jeff turned to face Train's headstone in silence, bracing against the cold breeze until the chief walked off into the night. He pondered the story the Reverend had told him about his friend's last days, and like Train, he also felt as if he was crossing some kind of invisible threshold, but his own passage seemed quite different. Train had sought redemption, a way back from a destructive path that threatened to consume him, and perhaps he had found his way before he died. Jeff sensed the threshold of a murkier world, where disputes were no longer settled with fisticuffs and alliances were not displayed on the back of a jacket but rather held close to the chest, and where men with power dispensed their will upon the lesser people in their midst with little empathy or concern. They find a way to get to you, Train. They figure out what matters most to you, and they use it against you. He gazed down at the headstone one last time. But I've got something inside me that's stronger than them. Something they'll never break. And you'll always be a part of that, my friend. He scooped up the remaining snow atop the headstone and packed it into a snowball, turning his attention to the oak tree still taunting him from the bottom of the hill. He cocked his arm back and hurled the snowball with all his might, watching as it sailed true to its mark, striking the center of the tree midway up its trunk. "Bullseye," he said, marveling at the accuracy of the throw. He picked up the crystal decanter from the snow and strode downhill past the oak tree out of the cemetery, heading home again to return the keepsake bottle to its proper place and hopefully spend the night in the comfort of his own bed. The silver Volvo station wagon with the cracked front grille backed into a sunlit parking space in an empty lot behind Madison General Hospital. Brain shifted the car into park and shut off the engine.
"You sure you have time for this?"
he asked his friend in the passenger seat.
"Your train leaves in an hour."
"We're 10 minutes away. We got time." Jeff pointed to a door set by the nearest corner of a towering cement structure. "Is that the way in? I don't see anyone." Just then, the door opened and Crazy Leg stuck his head outside. He shielded his eyes from the bright sunlight before spotting the Volvo and waving at it.
"Let's go."
Brain unbuckled his seatbelt and popped open his door. Jeff hopped out and joined his friends at the front of the car. Together, they hustled to the door now held ajar by a crumpled paper cup and entered the building. Inside the dim stairwell, they saw that Crazy Legs had already ascended 2 flights of cement stairs to the second floor. "How far up?" Jeff asked.
9th floor,
Crazy Legs called down.
"Watch out for cops. I've seen a few."
"You want to take the elevator?"
Brain asked. Jeff gazed up the stairwell. "No, let's do this." They charged up the staircase quickly at first, predictably tiring as they reached the higher floors. Panting, Jeff pulled open the stairwell door of the 9th floor to find Crazy Leg standing before a bank of elevators, motioning him to wait. He waved them forward a moment later and said,
"All clear."
Jeff followed him along a brightly lit corridor while Brain dallied behind with an eye on the elevators. They walked down a long corridor with windows to their right until Crazy Legs stopped just beyond earshot of a busy nursing station. He pointed his thumb to the left and said,
"Room 904.
"You're not coming?" Jeff asked. Crazy Legs shook his head.
"I'll hang back and keep watch."
"Okay, I won't be long." Jeff turned down the corridor to his left, where nurses and orderlies bustled about their tasks without paying him any heed. He stopped at the second room on the right with Brain still shadowing him and gently rapped his knuckles upon the open door. Inside the room, Axel pivoted on crutches, his right foot encased in a protective boot.
"Hey, look! It's Jeff!"
Jeff stepped inside the room to see TJ, Denny, and Bumbles all sitting beside a hospital bed, where Mick lay with 3 bandaged limbs immobilized by a traction device.
"Jeff,"
he exclaimed.
"I figured you were long gone by now."
Jeff stepped into the room and squeezed Mick's blanketed toes in greeting. "You guys look like you've been through a war." TJ lifted his left arm in a full cast and sling.
"Yeah, so much for basketball season."
Denny replied through clenched teeth. Bumbles pointed a thumb at him.
"His jaw's wired shut."
"Every cloud has a silver lining."
TJ grinned until Denny socked him in the stomach. Axel squeezed his ribs and winced.
"Ow! Oh, don't make me laugh."
Jeff smiled and turned to Bumbles. "I didn't expect to see you here. I figured they'd have you on a bus to the big house by now." Bumbles laughed.
"No. They charged me with obstructing justice and assaulting a police officer. My dad totally flipped out. He even refused to post my bail at first."
Jeff shook his head. "Sorry about that. I appreciate what you did, though."
"You're kidding, right? I'd do it again 100 times after what you did for me."
Jeff shuffled his feet and glanced about the serious faces of his friends. "Well, I just came to say goodbye. I know I said I didn't need the hurricanes anymore. Truth is, I wouldn't be here right now without you."
"Where's Crazy Legs?"
Bumbles asked.
I thought he'd be here.
He's down the hall,
Brain said.
He's keeping watch.
Mick shook his head.
Nah, he's just pissed at me. Funny how sticking a gun in your friend's gut can change his opinion about you.
A few of the Hurricanes laughed nervously, but Jeff sensed the regret in his friend's voice. Give him time. He'll come around.
I hope so. I'm gonna need all the friends I can get once I get out of here. I hear the prosecutor wants my ass in a sling over the gun.
You'll be okay, Jeff told him. It's not like you actually shot anyone.
Try as you might,
Brain added. Mick snarled at him and Axel chuckled painfully again. Jeff laughed, but he quickly fell somber. Anyway, I better go. If the cops find me here, I'm toast.
Still on the run?
Axel asked. Let's just say the chief is gonna look the other way while I slide out of town, on account of my amazing valor in saving his daughter's life. He smiled at his own pomposity and humbly added, Thanks for flossing his ass for me.
We just told him how it was,
TJ said.
You were awesome. The way you lit Curly up, man, I was never so proud to be a Hurricane.
Denny agreed through his teeth. Mick nodded.
I wish I had seen it. Seeing Curly sob like a baby would have made all this worthwhile.
Axel frowned.
So what does Chief Wellis get in return?
Jeff grimaced. I had to promise him I wouldn't see Cindy again. It's the only reason I'm not in jail. I'm not even supposed to be here right now.
What a snake,
TJ said.
He ain't doing you any favors. He's looking out for himself.
Does she even know you're leaving?
Axel asked. I doubt it, Jeff said. I don't even know where she is.
Second floor,
Bumbles blurted out.
I saw her friend Shannon on the elevator this morning and...
Jeff held up his hand. I'm probably better off not knowing.
So, where are you going?
Now you're better off not knowing, Jeff smiled. And if anyone asks, you didn't see me here.
Well, don't forget about your brothers back home,
Mick said.
Let me know if you need some more cash when you get there. You're good for it.
Axel nodded.
And I'll fix your car if you get it towed to my house.
Thanks. I'll let my mom know. But you got your work cut out for you this time. Jeff scanned the sullen faces of his friends, contemplating his imminent departure. Hey, look. I'll always be a Hurricane at heart. And I'll be back again someday. I swear. An awkward silence swept over the room as all seven boys searched for words to express themselves. Finally, Mick held out his one good arm.
Through thick and thin.
Jeff stepped forward and clasped his hand firmly. Our blood and skin
is one,
the Hurricanes chorused. Jeff waved goodbye to his friends and left the room. He strode past the nurse's station back to the main corridor while Brain scurried after him.
You really think she's here?
His friend asked.
In this hospital?
Makes sense, Jeff said. It's the closest one. Brain hustled to keep up.
So, what are you gonna do?
Jeff shrugged. I gave the man my word, and I gotta catch a train. As they neared the stairwell door at the end of the hallway, Crazy Legs burst through the doorway with alarm on his face. He rushed to the elevator bank and pressed the call button.
Cop!
He whispered.
I think he saw me.
Jeff looked about for an alternative escape route, but to his relief, the middle elevator chimed its arrival, and its metal doors slid open. Crazy Legs entered the empty car first and frantically pressed the lobby call button as Brain followed him inside, while Jeff entered the car last, instinctively turning to face the front of the car. The doors began to shut just as Officer Boyd stormed out from the stairwell.
You! Stop!
He shouted at the trio in the elevator. The doors slid shut in his face, but not before he locked eyes with Jeff standing in the center of the car.
That was close,
Brain said as they descended.
We better go while the getting's good.
Jeff exhaled slowly, unsure if Officer Boyd had identified him. He glanced up to the lighted numbers over the silver doors, watching their descent from the 7th to the 6th to the 5th floor. As they neared the 3rd floor, he reached out a finger to light the number 2 button on the control panel. Brain's mouth dropped open.
Jeff, don't. You'll ruin everything for yourself.
Pull the car around front, Jeff replied. He pulled his hood over his head and turned to Crazy Legs. Come with me.
You found her,
Crazy Legs said.
But you can't...
Brain shook his head.
Jeff!
The door slid open on the 2nd floor and Jeff stepped out. Do it. I'll be out front in 5 minutes. Crazy Legs hurried out as the silver doors shut behind him.
Chief Wellis won't cut you any more slack.
I don't care. I have to see her. He strode halfway down the corridor, but Crazy Legs trotted up and grabbed his arm.
This is a private wing,
he explained, motioning to a solitary nurse sitting at a reception desk at the far end of the corridor.
She'll want to know why you're here.
Jeff stopped. What should I do?
Wait here.
Crazy Legs motioned to the artwork lining the walls of the corridor.
Look at the pictures or something. I'll see if I can lead her away.
Jeff frowned. What room is she in? How will I find her? His friend shrugged.
I don't know. Follow your heart.
Jeff nodded and ambled up to a seascape hanging on the corridor wall while his friend continued onward to the reception station. He viewed the painting superficially at first, watching from the corner of his eye as Crazy Legs greeted the nurse and began to spin his yarn. After a few moments, however, the blue pastels of ocean and sky lured his thoughts to a shoreline he had yet to see, where vibrant sunsets glistened off deep waves cresting beyond a sandy coast. The painting seemed like a portal he could climb through, offering the promise of a future that demanded the present world be left behind. He felt both anticipation and regret, knowing that one last farewell remained before he could embark on a new reality. He turned back toward the reception station and saw that Crazy Legs had succeeded in luring the portly redhead nurse away. Stepping briskly to the console, he spotted them wandering down the corridor to the left, staring down together at the white-tiled floor. The hallway to the right led him toward an older wing of the hospital, where bright sunlight shone through long panes of glass, glistening off the white tiles descending a gentle ramp. At the bottom of the ramp, the tiles gave way to an indigo carpet, marking the transition to the private wing and a half dozen doorways on the left side of the corridor. He paused briefly outside the first room, but felt compelled to move on to the 2nd doorway, quietly inching his way inside the spacious room, its high ceiling reminiscent of the hospital's earlier days. The bed was tucked around the corner of the bathroom, set to face a tall window slightly ajar to help cool the warm room. Peering around the corner into the room, he saw Cindy sitting upright in the bed with her knees bent to support a magazine and a paper bracelet around her wrist. He stared at the soft brown hair tumbling about her fair face as if trying to engrave an image in his mind. Cindy looked up and gasped. She dropped the magazine on her lap and stretched her arms out toward him.
My hero!
He stepped up and greeted her with a kiss. How are you feeling? No tubes or wires, I see.
I'm okay. I have a big black and blue mark on my ribs, but nothing's broken. They said they're going to discharge me this afternoon.
She looked down solemnly at her lap.
I wasn't sure if you were ever going to come.
Jeff took her hands in his. It's all I've been thinking about, but I had to work something out first.
Detective Shelnick told me the whole story last night. Everyone he talked to told him how fantastic you were.
He smiled humbly. I wasn't feeling fantastic. I just did what I had to do.
I think I remember some of it. Maybe I was just dreaming.
Jeff released her hands before drifting away from her bedside to the open window. He gazed out across the groomed front lawn of the hospital, where a few small patches of snow still resisted the bright sunshine. To his left, The silver Volvo circled a horseshoe driveway past the front entrance of the hospital before stopping farther along the curbside, nearer to him. He stared down at the idling car, remembering how little time he had left to be with her.
I was thinking, now that this ordeal is over, maybe we could pick up where we left off? It'd be nice just to be your girlfriend again.
He swallowed the lump in his throat. That would be nice. She frowned.
What's the matter? You don't seem very happy.
He returned to the edge of the bed. I can't see you anymore, he said bluntly. Her pupils darted about as his words sank in.
Why not?
He slid beside her and looked into her eyes. I have to go. This is my last stop. I'm not even supposed to be here right now. Lines of pain emerged on her face.
Where are you going? When are you coming back?
California. I don't know when I'm coming back. She mulled his answer for a moment before wiping tears from her eyes.
So, why did you come here? To make me cry? To break my heart?
No, not to break your heart. He drew a deep breath. I thought it would hurt you more if I never said goodbye.
Well, say it then,
she sobbed.
Goodbye.
He stepped closer and gently stroked her hair. Everyone's talking about how I saved your life. Nobody knows about how you saved mine. He kissed her softly on the top of her head and turned to leave. I'm sorry. She dried her tears with her hands and furrowed her brow.
Wait a minute. What did you mean by supposed to?
He stopped. Huh?
You said you weren't supposed to be here. Why aren't you supposed to be here, Jeff?
He cast his eyes down and shuffled his feet. Your father said I...
My father? What does my father have to do with this?
Jeff cast a nervous glance to the doorway before returning to her side. He said I can't see you anymore. He said he's going to pull you out of Salisbury High next week. He squeezed her hands. He made me agree to a deal.
What kind of deal?
She asked sternly. Jeff looked down. He said he's going to look the other way while I get out of town. He said he's going to arrest me if I come anywhere near you. She threw her blanket off her legs and swung them around to sit on the edge of the bed.
Let me tell you something about my father. My father will twist any arm and step on any toes to get his way. He does it to the crooks, he does it to the cops. Sometimes he even does it to his own family. It's how he got to where he is today.
He frowned. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, I finally met someone who wasn't afraid to take him on. Someone who could look him in the eye and not back down.
A lot of good that did me. She looped an arm around his neck.
He didn't rescue me, Jeff. You did. Don't let him force you to do something you don't want to do. If you just don't want to be with me, I can live with that. But please don't do it because of my father. I love him, but he's controlled my life for too long now.
He's relentless. I need something to counter him with.
You have me.
She kissed him on the cheek.
Me and my love.
Once again, her words rang true. Whatever he chose to do, he was stronger with her by his side. And while rejecting the chief's deal seemed wrong, it also felt so right. His anxiety and gloom melted away, replaced by defiance and gallantry. The traits he had always held dearest in his heart. He was, after all, Jeff Hollister. He stood up with a gleam in his eye. Want to take a chance? You want to come with me? She beamed.
To the ends of the earth.
He kissed her lips and tugged at her hands. Then follow me. I have a plan. The portly nurse led Crazy Legs back toward the central reception station as he continued to scan the floor.
I'm sorry about your necklace. If you leave me your phone number, I'll have the night nurse call you if she finds it.
She stepped behind the desk in search of a pen and paper while he glanced down the main corridor toward the elevators. The center car chimed its arrival, and Chief Wellis stepped out, flanked by Officer Boyd and Sergeant Hurst, the latter sporting a large adhesive bandage across his forehead. Their hard heels clacked upon the tiles as they marched together down the corridor in unison. Officer Boyd pointed at Crazy Legs.
That's one of them.
The skinny boy started up the corridor toward them.
Chief Wellis, I was looking for you. I forgot to tell you something.
Sergeant Hurst brushed him aside.
Save it, Kramer. We got bigger fish to fry.
Where's Jeff Hollister?
Chief Wellis asked as they sauntered past him. Crazy Legs trotted after them.
I thought he was...
The nurse smiled at the lawman as they approached her station.
Good morning, Mr. Wellis,
she said cheerfully. The chief shot back a scornful look.
Nurse, I left specific instructions that my daughter was not to have any unapproved visitors.
Her jaw dropped open as she looked about.
Visitors? I didn't...
Chief Wellis held up his hand to cut her off in mid-sentence as he rounded the corner with his men at his heels. She bolted from the desk and scurried after them, while Crazy Legs jostled ahead of everyone and turned about to back down the tiled ramp before them.
Chief, you don't understand,
he gasped.
It's really important.
The chief refused to look at him.
Officer Boyd, if Mr. Kramer continues to obstruct us, place him under arrest. Sergeant Hurst, when we locate Jeff Hollister, you are to use whatever means necessary to take him into custody immediately.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
The two policemen answered. Officer Boyd reached for Crazy Legs, but he darted away, running past the closed door of Cindy's room to a safe distance down the carpeted hallway. Looking back, he saw the chief open the door and enter the room with his subordinates and the nurse filing in behind him. A cry of despair suddenly filled the hallway. Unnerved, Crazy Legs dashed back to the entrance of the room, nudging past the nurse into the center of the room, where he beheld an empty hospital bed and long curtains blowing in the breeze from a window fully open. The two police officers stood dumbfounded at the foot of the bed, while their chief glared out the window at the red taillights of a silver Volvo station wagon vanishing down a side street amidst the bustling midday traffic. Chief Wellis slammed his fist upon the windowsill with a loud curse.
Damn it!
He whirled about and barreled past Crazy Legs on a beeline for the door, with the nurse and Officer Boyd both running after him. Crazy Legs tried to follow, but Hurst blocked his path with eyes bulging and teeth gnashing. The skinny boy bit his lip, trying to maintain a straight face at the sergeant's fuming emotions, but Hurst simply shoved him back onto the bed before storming out of the room after the others. Crazy Legs bounced to a rest upon the soft mattress with his eyes staring at the ceiling, holding his belly and laughing hysterically. The end.